Good morning. The scripture reading this morning is going to be Psalm 38. Psalm 38. O Lord, rebuke me not in your anger, nor discipline me in your wrath. For your arrows have sunk into me, and your hand has come down on me. There is no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There's no health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They're too heavy for me. My wounds stink and fester because of my foolishness. I'm utterly bowed down and prostrate all the day I go about mourning. For my sides are filled with burning and there's no soundness in my flesh. I'm feeble and crushed. I groan because of the tumult of my heart. O Lord, all my longing is before you. My sighing is not hidden from you. My heart throbs, my strength fails me. In the light of my eyes, it also has gone from me. My friends and companions stand aloof from my plague, and my nearest kin stand far off. Those who seek my life lay their snares. Those who seek my hurt speak of ruin and meditate treachery all day long. But I'm like a deaf man, I do not hear, like a mute man who does not open his mouth. I become like a man who does not hear, and whose mouth are no rebukes. But for you, O Lord, do I wait. It is you, O Lord, my God, who will answer. For I said, only let them not rejoice over me, who boast against me when my foot slips. For I am ready to fall, and my pain is ever before me. I confess my iniquity, I'm sorry for my sin. But my foes are vigorous, they are mighty, and many are those who hate me wrongfully. Those who render me evil for good accuse me because I follow after good. Do not forsake me, O Lord. O my God, be not far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord of my salvation. O Lord, my salvation.
Y'all are going to have to bear with me. Since 7 o'clock yesterday morning, I'm living on 2 hours of sleep and coffee. So if I lose my track, y'all throw something at me and try to get me back on track. That'll work. All right. Today, Lord willing, we're going to go through 1 Samuel chapter 11. I'm going to start off and we're going to read. Nahash, the Ammonite, came up and laid siege to Jabesh Gilead. All the men of Jabesh said to him, make a treaty with us and we will serve you. Nahash, the Amorite, replied, I will make one with you on this condition, that I gouge out everyone's right eye and humiliate all Israel. Don't do anything to us for 7 days, the elders of Jabesh said to him, and let us send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. If no one saves us, we will surrender to you. When the messengers came to Gibeth, Saul's hometown, and told the terms to the people, all wept aloud. Just then Saul was coming in from the field behind his oxen. What's the matter with the people? Why are they weeping? Saul inquired, and they repeated to him the words of the men of Jabesh. When Saul heard these words, the Spirit of God suddenly took control of him, and his anger burned furiously. He took a team of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent them throughout the land of Israel by messengers, who said, this is what will be done to the ox of anyone who doesn't march behind Saul and Samuel. As a result, the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they went out united. Saul counted them at Bezek, There were 300,000 Israelites and 30,000 men from Judah. He told the messengers who had come, "Tell this to the men of Jabesh Gilead. Deliverance will be yours tomorrow by the time the sun is hot." So the messengers told the men of Jabesh, and they rejoiced. Then the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Tomorrow will come out, and you can do whatever you want to us." The next day, Saul organized the troops into three divisions. During the morning watch, they invaded the Amorites' camp and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. There were survivors, but they were so scattered that no two of them were left together. Afterwards, the people said to Samuel, "Who said that Saul should not reign over us? Give us those men so we can kill them." But Saul ordered, "No one will be executed this day, for today the Lord has provided deliverance in Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal, so we can renew the kingship there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there in the Lord's presence they made Saul king. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings in the Lord's presence, and Saul and all the men of Israel greatly rejoiced. There's a lot that happens in that very short chapter. And I'm going to be honest with you. There's not a lot of people that do a whole lot of commentary on that chapter. Believe me, I have looked. I did find something very interesting. Nahash is Hebrew for serpent. It is only used two times, and it's not clear from the commentary I found whether it is two separate people or the same person. And so that's just kind of a little interesting side note that someone whose name means serpent is attacking the city. So it doesn't sound like a very nice guy to begin with. In this chapter, we have the first fruits of Saul's government in the glorious rescue of Jabesh Gilead out of the hands of the Amorites. Let's not infer that they did well to ask for a king, because God could and would have saved them without one. But instead, let's admire God's goodness that He did not reject them when they rejected Him, and acknowledge God's wisdom in the choice of the person whom, if He did not find fit, He made fit for the great trust He called him to. Another little interesting thing I found out, and I know I've read it, but it came back. The Amorites were descendants of Lot, and for that reason, dealt severally with by Israel. And I've given out some little verses, and I believe I gave Deuteronomy 2:19 to someone. Okay.
"And when thou comest nigh over against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them, for I will not give the land of the children of Ammon any possession, because I have given it unto the children of Lot for a possession."
So, right there in Deuteronomy, these are Lot's, and everybody just leaves them alone because they're Lot's descendants, and it's been ordered in. Do not mess with them. Here's my tired brain kicking in. I apologize. Japheth, in his time, had humbled them. But now the sin of Israel had put them into a capacity to make head again and avenge that quarrel. I gave someone Judges 11:33. Okay.
"And he smote them from Aroer, even till very great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel.
So there, Japheth slaughtered them. And now they have the capacity to strike back. The city of Jabesh Gilead had been some ages ago destroyed by Israel's sword of justice for not appearing against the wickedness of Gibeth. Again, my tired brain, I apologize. Judges 21:10 through 11.
So the congregation sent out there 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, "Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, including the women and the children. And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man in Tekoa."
So Jabesh Gilead had been utterly and completely destroyed. And now, Naash, the king of Ammon, is laying siege to it again. The Gileadites said to him in verse 1, "Make a covenant with us, and we will surrender upon terms and serve you." Had the Gileadites not broken their covenant with God and forsaken His service, they needed not to have courted a covenant with the Amorites and offered themselves to serve them. So their own breaking of the covenant has brought this upon them, and now they're suffering for it. The Ammonites offer them barbarous conditions. They will spare their lives and take them to be their servants upon the condition that they shall put out their right eyes. So it's not good enough. We will want you to put out your right eye. Literally, and in my studies, it literally means to scoop or hollow out the ball. We're not talking just poke you an eye and put it out. Literally pull the ball from the socket. And that's in verse 2. The Gileadites were content to part with their liberty and estates for the ransom of their blood. And had the Amorites taken them at their word, the matter would have been settled immediately. And the Gileadites would have not sent out for relief. But the Amorites couldn't be content to have them for servants. They must torment them and put them to pain, such extreme pain that the thrusting out of an eye would do. They also, in doing this, would disable them for war and render them incapable, not of labor, because that would have been no use to the Ammonites, but of bearing arms. For in those times they fought with shields in their left hands, which covered their left eye. So that if a soldier without his right eye was in effect blind, because you couldn't look around the shield and see what was coming at you. And then they would put so much a reproach upon all of Israel as weak and cowardly that would suffer the inhabitants of one of their chief cities to be so miserably used and not offered rescue. So they wanted to completely humiliate them, never wanted to have to worry about them striking back at them. And cause them as much pain as possible. The Israelites desire and obtain 7 days' time to consider this proposal. In verse 3. Nahash, probably not imagining it possible that in such a short time they should have relief, and being very secure of his advantage he thought he had against them, agreed to give them the 7 days that the reproach upon Israel. You agreed to give them 7 days. that the reproach upon Israel for not rescuing them might be the greater and his triumphs the more illustrious. But there was providence in that his security might be his ruin. So he's pretty confident. Hey, I've got him beat. Go ahead, take 7 days. See if anybody wants to help you. I don't think you can get it together, and I'm going to come in there and scoop out your eyes. I mean, we read that opening Psalm 38, and I felt like that kind of led to the position that the Israelites were in at that time. How much sin and sorrow were they feeling to say, okay, we'll even scoop out our eyes if, you know, just give us 7 days to think about it. Notice the sent to Gibeth. They said they would send messengers to all the coast of Israel in verse 3, which made Nahash the more secure, for he thought it would be a work of time and none would appear if they had no common head. And perhaps Nahash had not yet heard of the newly elected king. But the messengers, either of their own accord or by order from their masters, went straight to Gibeth, and not finding Saul within, told their news to the people. And in verse 4 it says, they fell and wept upon hearing it. They would sooner lament their brethren's misery and danger than think of helping them. They would shed their tears for them than shed their blood. They wept as despairing to help the men of Jabesh Gilead, and fearing least, if that frontier city should be lost, the enemy would penetrate into the very bowels of their country, which now appeared to be in great hazard. So they're upset, but they're too scared to go out and do anything. We feel bad for you. I'm going to cry, but I'm not going to go risk my life for you. So in 11:5 through 11, this shows Saul and the happy fruits of the Spirit which God had put on him. One, his humility. Though Saul was king and had been anointed king, he did not think it below him to know the state of his own flocks, but went himself to see them and came in the evening with the servants after the herd out of the field, as we see in verse 5. This was evidence that he was not puffed up in his advancement, as most people would be apt to be if they had been pulled out of a sheep herder or goat herder and made into a king. You go from a normal everyday life and, oh, I'm king now. I ain't got to go out in the field. No, he continued to go in the field. Providence had not found him business as a king, and he left everything to Samuel. And therefore, rather than be idle and do nothing, he applied himself in his country business. Like Paul, he worked with his hands, for if he neglected his domestic affairs, how must he maintain himself and his family? Solomon gives it as a reason why men should look well on their herds, because the crown doeth not endure to every generation. I gave someone Proverbs 27:23-27.
Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself, and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in, the lambs will provide your clothing, and the goat the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household, and the nourishment of your maidservants.
And another proof of this is Saul's kingdom did not last forever, as we're going to see later on. He must therefore provide something sure. Another point is his concern for his neighbors. When he perceived them in tears and asked, "What ails the people that they weep?" So he had concern for his neighbors. His zeal for the safety and honor of Israel, when he heard of the Amorites and the distress of the city, it says the Spirit of God came upon him, and his anger was kindled greatly in verse 6. So what was he angry about? Anybody? Any ideas? Yeah, he was angry about the Amorites. That's and probably the demands that they put on him, and that they are attacking the city.
That it was dishonoring to God that they would weep and not attempt to.
Yes.
Organize.
Yeah, he's angry because his neighbors are weeping. He's angry because they should be preparing for war. Instead, they're going to sit around and cry about it. That's another thing. He sent a summons after his anger to all of Israel. And in this summons, he took a yoke of oxen and hewn them in pieces. So he took a group of oxen, he cut them up in little pieces, just like you would butcher a deer. And this is a particular form of a war summons that was used. Let's see. This particular form of war summons was suited to the character and habits of an agricultural and pastoral people. It was solemn in itself. The denunciation and accompanied it. I'm sorry. My eyes are slowly going down. The coffee's not helping. The denunciation that accompanied it carried a terrible threat to those that neglected to obey it. You'd get your oxen cut up. Saul also conjoins the name of Samuel with his own to lend greater influence to the measure and to strike greater terror unto all who would not follow the order. But he does not say, if you don't follow me, this will be done to you. He says, this shall be done to your oxen. God had threatened it as a great judgment. And I believe I gave that to somebody in Deuteronomy 28:31. Okay.
Thine ox shall be slain before thine eyes, and thou shalt not eat thereof. Thine ass shall be violently taken away from before thy face, and thou shalt not be restored to thee. Thy sheep shall be given unto thine enemies, and thou shalt have none to rescue them.
It was necessary that the command should be enforced with some penalty. But this was not nearly so severe as that which was affixed to a similar order by the whole congregation, as seen in Judges 21:5. And I don't know who I gave that to. Did I miss one? I might have missed one. Judges 21:5. Okay. I appreciate it. I apologize.
Not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be
So the similar order was that person would be put to death, not oxen or animals. In this, Saul wished to show that his government was more gentle than that which they had been under. The effect of the summons was that the militia or trained bands of the nation came out as one man. And the reason given is the fear of the Lord fell upon them. Saul did not make them fear him, but they were influenced to observe his orders by the fear of God and to regard him who made Saul their king and them members under one nation. Those that fear God will make conscious of their duty to all men, particularly their rulers. If I'm going too fast or y'all have questions, throw your hands up, because I'm trying to stay awake and I don't want to miss anybody. Saul's prudent proceedings in this great affair, as shown in verse 8, he numbered those men that came to him, that he might know his own strength and how to distribute his forces in the best manner their numbers would allow. In this, it seems, Judah, which was one of the larger cities and was extremely numbered by itself, made no great figure. For as it was one tribe of 12, so it was but an 11th part of the whole number. It was numbered only 30,000. So they didn't come out the way they should have. And it says back, I'm kind of lost my place, but it says back that they didn't really support Saul. And so they sent a very, you know, hey, we can get by with sending 30,000 people, and we're not going to send as many as we can. Saul's faith and confidence and his courage and resolution in this enterprise is another point that shows that God had moved him. It should seem that those very messengers who brought the tidings from Jabesh-Gilead, Saul sent into the country to raise the militia, who would be sure to be faithful and careful in their new task. He now sends them back to their distressed countrymen with this assurance. Tomorrow, now they've come from all over the coast of Israel. They've gone out and they've gone to all the tribes of Israel. Now they're sending them back. Tomorrow, you shall have deliverance, it says in verse 9. They can't jump in their cars. They're not flying by plane. These men are running. It says nothing about them on horses. They may have been. But I'm going to say they're probably on foot. So be you ready to do part, and we will do ours. Saul knew he had just cause and a clear call, and God was on his side, and therefore doubted not of success. When the Gileadites received this, it was good news. And I want you to look what they did here. They sent into the enemy's camp, and I'm going to go over here to verse 10, because I think it says it better than I did. Then the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Tomorrow we will come out, and you can do whatever you want to us." So what did they do? "We're going to come out. So we're going to come right on out there." I've added a little bit to it, and I think that probably reads a lot better. "To tell them the next day to meet them, in which the enemies understood as that they were coming out and had no relief coming." So the enemies, Nahash and his men, were made more secure, thinking that they had won. The Gittites were under no obligation to give them notice that help was assured. So they didn't say, yeah, we'll come out, but we're bringing 330,000 men with us. They said, yeah, we'll come out to you tomorrow and you do what you want to with us. Not, we're going to come out 330,000 men strong and, yeah, you go ahead and do what you want to with us. Saul's industry and close application to this business shows that if he would be understood if he had been bred up to war from his youth and had led regiments as often as he had followed or led flocks. He could not have gone about an affair of this nature more diligently. Because when the Spirit of the Lord comes upon men, it will make them experts even without experience. So, when it's God's will, God will move you, just like, and He will direct you. All you have to do is have the faith in Him to let Him direct you. Also, this goes back to what I was saying. Saul had a long march before him. As best I can tell, and from everything I read, it was nearly 60 miles. And he had to do this in a day. He had no cavalry in his army, only infantry. And he had divided them into three battalions in verse 11. So let's imagine we've got to walk 60 miles. How many people think they could do it in a day and a night? I see you shaking your head. You can do it in a day and a night. Oh, okay. Yeah, they could because they were doing work other than man's. So what incredible swiftness he moved to the enemy. In a day and a night, he came to the place where the action was to take place, where his own fate and that of Israel must be determined. He had passed his word along and would not break it. And he was better than his word, for he promised help the next day by the time the sun was hot in verse 9. He brought it before day in the morning watch. So he said he'd be there by the time the sun was hot. He made it by that morning, it says in verse 11. Whom God helps, He helps right early. And I gave Psalm 46:5 to somebody? Or is that another one I missed? Okay.
God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her just at the break of dawn.
To complete His honor, God crowned all these virtues with success. So what virtues are we talking about? Well, Jabesh Gilead was rescued. Help made it in time. The Amorites were not just defeated, they were totally defeated. He had now the day before him to complete his victory. And so complete a victory it was that those who remained of the Amorites after the great slaughter were scattered so that two men of them were not left together and could not help one another, in verse 11. Now, I don't know exactly how many men they had, but they scattered them and defeated them so greatly that they could not even come together, two men, to help one another. You have scattered an army when you have done that. So after this great victory, the people took this occasion to show their jealousy for the honor of Saul, and their resentment for the indignities done to him. Verse 12. In verse 12 it says, "Afterwards the people said to Samuel, 'Who said that Saul should not reign over us? Give us those men so that we can kill them.'" Now Saul has done a great victory for them, they feel. So, hey, we're on his side now. He did good. We want the people who said he can't be our king. We'll kill them. But Saul took this occasion to give further proof of his clemency. For without waiting on Samuel's answer or his approval, Saul himself squashed that motion in verse 13. There shall not a man be put to death this day. It says in 13, Saul ordered, "No one will be executed this day. For today the Lord has provided deliverance in Israel." This was a day of joy and triumph. On that day, the Lord has wrought salvation in Israel. And since God has been so good to all of Israel, let not one of Israel be harsh to another one. After this, Samuel took this occasion to call all the people together before the Lord in Gilgal, verses 14 and 15, that they might publicly give thanks to God for their victory. Samuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal, so we can renew our kingship there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there in the Lord's presence, they made Saul their king, and they sacrificed fellowship offerings in the Lord's presence. And Saul and all of Israel's men greatly rejoiced. He also took the opportunity to make Saul, Saul had already been anointed king, but he took this opportunity to confirm, "Saul is now your king. He's done a great thing. Let's confirm that he is king and celebrate." They rejoiced greatly, and that God might have the praise of that which he had the comfort of. They sacrificed to him as the giver of all their success. They sacrificed peace offerings and other sacrifices.